From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Let me tell you something. Every Christian, every pastor out there that voted for Joe Biden last night, you have brought a curse upon yourself and your family, your children, and your children's children down to the third and fourth generation, and you need to repent.
While the most divisive rhetoric may have receded for now from the national stage, the lasting impact on communities, congregations, and even families continue to divide. A recent gathering of evangelical faith leaders revealed both the depths of the wounds and the hunger for healing. On this week's show, you'll meet Pastor Mike Goldsworthy, organizer of the post-evangelical gathering last month.
As Americans, we have more in common than what separates us.
As this country and culture seem to fracture more and more along lines of partisanship, religion, and ideology, the new Public Religion Research Institute American Values Survey offers up this nugget of hope. 3 in 4 of us still believe it possible for us to live into our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. And that statistic holds across every population group and demographic. The survey is published annually, and this time around, the Institute has taken on a truly monumental challenge to gauge what Americans believe makes one an American. These and a myriad other insights are available in the just-released survey, and we'll get some highlights from PRRI CEO Dr. Robert P. Jones.
Just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change. You know, I mean, Jesus was a white man, too, but, you know, it's like, he was a historical figure. I mean, that's a verifiable fact.
Most of us would rather not hear that race and racism continue to play important roles, not only in our culture, but in the forces that seem to dominate American public religion. Nonetheless, credible speakers and authors who have spent time living within and carefully analyzing the structures of power and influence in this country quite remarkably reach similar conclusions again and again. Now comes Dr. Randall Balmer, a religion historian, college professor, prolific author, and ordained pastor. Expert in the ways of American evangelicalism, he has just published his latest book titled Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right. He'll be back on State of Belief with details.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and unanswered prayers. Wow, with all that's happening in the world right now, look at what L.A. Archbishop Jose Gomez, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, chose to condemn in a fiery video speech to a global gathering of Catholics. It's what he called new social justice movements. He called them pseudo-religions that ultimately serve as dangerous substitutes for true religion. I gotta tell you, this all sounds vaguely familiar. I'm trying to remember who it was that sided with social justice movements in the good book. Meanwhile, the political religious right is claiming all the glory for the GOP wins in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Never mind that it was close and the issues were varied, good men of God like Mike Huckabee are declaring that concerted efforts to turn out Christian voters by his My Faith Votes organization resulted in wins over Democrats who, quote, reject the basic biblical values this nation was founded on, end quote. P.S. Send money. This is the messaging we're deploying nationwide next year. So, I guess we've been warned. And, man, how I'd love to leave the cartoonish Family Research Council out of these reports, but I get Tony Perkins's endless stream of emails, and it's astounding how anti-mercy and morality this multi-million dollar tax-exempt charity really is. The current fundraising focus? Stop Joe Biden from recognizing transgender people, especially the most vulnerable, trans youth. I guess as long as you ignore American families raising trans kids, the research on trans identity and focus on sending your dollars to The Council, you'll be able to sleep at night.
Our program airs every weekend on radio station nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. For 20 years, Mike Goldsworthy was a successful evangelical pastor in Long Beach, California. But like so many, he felt growing alarm over the political lockstep so many in the evangelical movement fell into, particularly during the Trump campaign and administration. Now, serving as adjunct homiletics professor at Hope International University, Mike has been building networks of support with fellow disaffected evangelical pastors and leaders, culminating in a gathering in South Bend, Indiana, last month. And I am really happy to welcome him today to State of Belief Radio. Mike Goldsworthy, thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Listen, I don't want to just start with this, but I've been down the same road that you've been down, and what strikes me immediately was that when I was going down that road, there weren't a lot of people trying to put something together to stop it, and you did, and that's good.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, this really kind of came about not trying to create, and we don't even have an organization. We weren't trying to create some sort of organization. It was simply meeting friends along the way who I resonated with. And every one of them would say a similar sort of story. I feel like I'm doing something new. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm the only one doing it. I feel all alone.
Yeah.
And so I just started saying, like, well, can I find ways to connect my friends who are feeling all alone as they're birthing some sort of new thing in the church, and just started figuring out ways to try to get people to connect with one another. Yeah.
Well, you called it a post-evangelical pastor and leader gathering. Let's start by talking about what that means to you.
Sure. Yeah. And I should say this, post-evangelical is nobody's favorite way of talking about this, but it is the sort of language that's being used in the larger arena. And so we've sort of grabbed a hold of that. And what that sort of has looked like is folks who have been formed in some sort of way by the evangelical church. Mm-hmm. And frankly, mostly like when we talk about the evangelical church, we're mostly talking about the white evangelical church.
Sure.
And so they've been formed in that, but for various reasons have found the evangelical church to not fit them anymore, and have moved out of it, but haven't left the church behind and don't fit in other like expressions within the church, like more mainline traditions, for all kinds of different reasons. And so kind of feel caught in this no man's land in between mainline tradition and evangelical tradition and sort of this in-between place.
Mm-hmm. Well, you told me right off why now, the reasons that you did this. Who was involved and how many showed up for this?
Sure. So we had somewhere around 120 folks from all over the U.S., coast to coast, from the South, from Northern Midwest, and they were largely church leaders. So I want to say, if I remember right, it was something close to 70% of them were pastors or pastoral staff on church staffs. Most of them were a part of churches that felt like they don't fit anywhere in the larger church landscape. Yeah. And a small percentage of them were pastors on staff at evangelical churches where they themselves felt out of line with where their church is at. And they're just trying to figure out where they belong.
What were the objectives of the gathering and the subjects that came up the most?
Sure. So our objectives were, we wanted to create solidarity amongst a group of people who felt alone. We wanted to create some space for people to be re-envisioned to the work that they felt God had been calling them to. And so we wanted to create some space for that. And we wanted to create some space for shared learnings, because as people are creating a new space in the church, they're out on their own innovating, and we wanted just people to be able to learn from each other. So we were trying to create some space for those sorts of things to happen. And then within that, I did a pre-gathering survey to ask people what they wanted to talk about. And a few of the things that were at the top of the list, people wanted to talk about how to sort of lead and guide and shepherd people in their churches through their own processes of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith. So pastors had gone through that experience themselves, but they weren't sure, like, how do I help lead others through that in healthy ways? They wanted to talk about LGBTQ inclusion and what does that look like to lead in that space. They wanted to talk about racial injustice and how do we engage in that well, and what does it look like for the church to take responsibility there. They wanted to talk about spiritual formation and what does it look like to be actually moving, like to be creating ways within our church structure and systems where we're helping people become more fully who God designed and created them to be. So I think those were some of the maybe top things that were being asked for.
You know, you wouldn't say it for yourself, but it strikes me that you were being a pastor for a whole lot of people who needed pastors.
Yeah, that's really kind. And I think from what I understand of your background, Walton, I think you understand this, that once you're a pastor, it's hard to stop pastoring people. And so, you know, I was at this church in Long Beach for about 20 years, and I'm still in Long Beach, California. And so, like, I'm still pastoring folks who are a part of my church. Like, you just because you're not getting a paycheck from that church, you don't stop doing that. And yeah, now I find myself doing that with pastors across the country where they're in various places theologically, various kinds of churches. And I find myself getting to pastor all kinds of different pastors.
Were you surprised at all by how many folks were resonating with what you were doing?
Yeah, I genuinely was actually shocked. So the short story of how this gathering came about was this church in South Bend had gotten a grant for me to do some work with them. And one of the things they asked me to do is they said, well, what if like at the end of our like grant year that you bring out a few of these pastors that you're connecting with to help our staff know that we're not alone, that there's other people doing this work and to meet a few of them. So I was going to bring four or five other pastors up with me. And then we said, well, what if we opened it up and we just like, there's probably some other folks that I don't know, we haven't connected with. And so like, let's see if we can find a few more. And I genuinely thought 25 people will show up and that would be a huge success. It would be a really big deal. And when 120 people, like, but one of my favorite stories of the gathering was a guy walked in and opened up the door to the lobby of the church that we were meeting in. And he just stopped and he gasped and he said, I had no idea there were so many of us.
Well, you know, I did go through a similar process many years ago as the Southern Baptist Convention lurched to the political hard right. I felt there was no place for me in those circles. It wasn't that I left the Southern Baptist Convention. The Southern Baptist Convention left me, and I think both of us were glad that I got out. It was a tough decision, though, to leave. But there comes a time when it is the right decision to leave. I'd like for you to tell some more of those stories that you heard in Indiana, because that's what gets people understanding about what we're doing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was a lot of folks who have felt displaced in a lot of different ways. So there's everything from a church who was there who had was a part of a denomination and they had gone through their own sort of study of scripture and ended up as a result of that becoming affirming in all ways of LGBTQ folks in their church, both in terms of being able to serve in all roles of leadership and perform weddings. And as a result of that, they were kicked out of their denomination, but not just kicked out of their denomination. They also lost their building that the denomination had a holding on. And that was just before the pandemic hit. So they have their church blow up. They're trying to figure out, like, how do we rebuild? Who are we now? And then the pandemic shuts them down. And so they've been isolated, not only in the same way that all of us were isolated during the pandemic, but they were isolated from having lost who their tribe was in their community. Mm-hmm. And so this became this place for them of this realization that they weren't alone, that there are other people who are locking arms with them, of new friendships, of new people who wanted to support them, work with them, help them. Mm-hmm. I think we also saw, one story of one gentleman who I heard after the first day, he called his wife that night and told his wife, he said to her, you know, in every other gathering that I've been in, I always feel like I'm the crazy one. And after this day, I feel like I'm no longer crazy. Mm-hmm. Like I found my people. Mm-hmm. I asked, there's a woman who came who is nationally recognized in a few circles, and she's a friend, and I pulled her aside early on the first day, and I said, hey, I know that pastor gatherings are very, very male-centric, and I feel like this one has a lot more women in it, but I'm like, I might be wrong. Like, am I just perceiving that? And she said, no, like, it's probably about 40% female, 60% male, where it's usually maybe 80, 85% male. Mm. And I said, like, what's that experience like for you? And she goes, I actually have felt like in this space, I don't have to fight for my voice. Yeah. So it was stories like that, where it was really stories of people feeling like they belong, people feeling like they weren't alone, feeling like there was room for them. Mm-hmm. And all of them trying to figure out, like, how do we do church? Like, now we're not ready to give up on the church. We're not a group of people that are saying, let's burn this thing down. That we're a group of people that are saying, there's something really beautiful and redemptive here. Mm-hmm. And what does it look like for us to, like, continue leaning into that and figure out how to be the church in our time and our place?
Great question. And that makes me have to ask, when you listen to those stories, what does that suggest as a way forward?
Yeah, I don't fully know. So I will say this, like, I am pretty committed to, like, this is not Mike Goldsworthy's thing. There is something that's brewing, so much so that that in the print edition of the Washington Post, this was on the front page below the fold last week. And so, like, that to me said, like, there's some sort of thing that's here that's happening. So I'm getting a group of folks together to essentially say, like, what does it look like? What does it look like for us to steward this well, to not just assume, like, well, what we need to do is just keep doing a bunch of gatherings or whatever, but that there is a longing for some sort of connection here. And I'm not going to put it on my shoulders to say I'm the person who figures this out. Mm-hmm. I want to reach out to the community of pastors who are helping to, like, to help guide this and to say, like, what is it that would look best here and be most helpful?
Yeah. What kind of responses have followed, whether positive or negative?
Yeah. So it is, I would say it's mostly positive. It's folks saying, like, oh, I'm so glad something like this is happening. I'm glad to see the church asking the kinds of questions that I've been asking and pastors in the space that I'm in. Because people have felt there's a lot of things being written and spaces for people that are going through this sort of movement in their faith. There's a lot less for pastors. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is a resonance of, I'm glad that there's something for pastors. Mm-hmm. Some of the criticism came around some accusations that I think are probably fair based off of what I saw being written of it being accused of just being a return to essentially like a neoliberal movement that's already been tried in the early 20th century. And I can understand some of those criticism based off of what was written, but I think actually what's happening is something that's entirely different mm-hmm. than that.
In your teaching position, you are exposed to young people of faith.
Sure.
What are your impressions of the impact these kinds of conflicts are having on young people, and who needs to hear about that as well as about the situation a growing number of post-evangelicals find themselves today?
Yeah. So the students that I work with are all ministry students. Like, they are intending to go into full-time vocational ministry. And I'm usually getting them in their junior and senior year when I'm working with them. Mm-hmm. And so they're thoughtful students who want to wrestle with hard questions of faith. They want to not be told exactly what they're supposed to think. They want to be able to engage in thoughtful dialogue that exposes them to different ways of understanding the scriptures and to come to their own conclusions with it. So I think that that's true both out of, like, they are not looking for the more conservative side to do that. They're also not looking for the more progressive side. Like, the school that I'm at is not it comes out of what's called the Restoration Movement, which doesn't fully fit in any kind of space either within the larger church landscape. And so they're not looking for, here's the conservative answers that I need to fall in line with. And they're not looking for, here's the progressive answers they need to fall in line with. They're looking for people to help them think critically about, what does it look like for me to live out my faith today? And I think that's the thing that I would offer, is that churches, and I see this, like, my experience is much more of churches that lean to the right, but I'm being exposed a lot more to churches that lean to the left. And I think that there's a bit of a dogmatism that's experienced in a lot of those spaces. And rather than, like, people want to learn to think critically about their mm-hmm. faith, and we sort of shut that down in different ways. And I think that, I actually think that's one of the ways forward, as we're seeing a significant decrease of engagement in church life amongst the younger generation, like a significant decline. And I think that one of the things that they're looking for is a space to be able to think critically about their faith.
You know, I thought this is crazy, I know, but one of the things that was most impressing for me, and something that I shouted when I found out, was that thinking is not a sin. And that was a freeing thing for me.
Right?
And so I knew that I was on another track that felt like what faith is. And it's always been that way since then.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually think we need more men and women who have gone through these sorts of journeys on their own, and have even moved beyond it just being an intellectual journey to being a contemplative journey. Absolutely. We are missing the mystics mm-hmm. and modern day mystics who can speak into our current landscape to talk about what it looks like to connect with the divine, moving beyond just a head journey or moving beyond just a purely emotional journey, mm-hmm. but something that that takes those into account, but is bigger and more than that.
Mike Goldsworthy is an empathetic organizer of the Ecclesiastically Homeless, working on bringing together alienated evangelical clergy and leaders to create less exclusionary structures. Last month, he organized a gathering in South Bend, Indiana, that drew over 100 participants. Mike, it's really good to speak with you. I affirm you and thank you for what you're doing for a whole lot of people who need what you're saying. We'll always welcome that.
Oh, thank you so much, Welton. It's really kind of you to have me on, and I'm grateful for having, like, folks like you who have gone before us and really laid some of the groundwork for us to be able to do some of this kind of work.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, the 2021 American Values Survey from the Public Religion Research Institute. And later, Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right, the latest book from historian Randall Balmer. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Among the important and in-depth surveys of Americans that the nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute regularly conducts, it's the wide-ranging American Values Survey that offers perhaps the most comprehensive look at who we are and who we think we are. The 2021 edition was released earlier this week, and I am delighted that it brings PRRI CEO Dr. Robert P. Jones back to State of Belief Radio. Robbie, thanks for being with us again. I always look forward to this one.
Thanks. You know, I'm happy to be here. I was trying to think back. We may have done every single one of these. This is our 12th year doing the American Value Survey. It's possible we may have done this every year.
I think we have. But for now, we'll just say we did.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Here we go. The title for this year's survey is Cultural Change and Anxiety in America. Talk about that title and what it says about this year's findings.
Yeah, you know, as has been true really for a number of years now, we've realized as we've gone to do the survey that we can't really understand American politics by just asking about issues anymore, like political issues or policy issues, that the things that are dividing us are much deeper than that. So we really are trying to get at Americans' attitudes around the bigger changes in the country, cultural changes, demographic changes, religious changes. That is really, I think, what is driving the big partisan divisions, and partisanship increasingly is less around whether we agree or disagree over abortion and more about whether we agree or disagree over who we are as Americans and who we should be as a country. One way of thinking about this is whether we, and I think a fault line that runs through many of the questions, is whether we think of America and our country as and what it means to be an American as an evolving identity that changes with the country, or whether we think of it as kind of a fixed culture. And that fixed culture, as we talked about before, is basically a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. And do we think of it as a fixed culture that's under attack with all the changes in the country?
You covered a lot of patriotic themes in this survey. Talk about what unites us and what divides us when it comes to our understanding of our nation.
Yeah, you know, there's still, I think, a surprising amount of optimism about whether America has been a force for good in the world. 3/4 of Americans say that America has always been a force for good in the world. And there's some partisan differences here, but both majorities of Republicans and Democrats agree. So it's 92% of Republicans who agree with that. But it's also 2/3 of Democrats. And if you look across the religious landscape, it's majorities of every religious group. White Christians are more likely to think this than everyone else in the religious landscape. But even religiously unaffiliated Americans, nearly 6 in 10 say this. You know, the other place where there's some agreement is we had a question about what does it mean to be, quote unquote, truly American? And we had a list of like 10 traits that we asked people to say whether they thought this was important or not for being, quote unquote, truly American. And we had 5 traits where, again, more than 3/4 of the country supports and majorities of both parties. So some really basic things like believing individual freedoms, such as freedom of speech, believing everyone should be able to vote, accepting people of diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds or religious backgrounds, respecting political institutions and laws, and being able to speak English. That last one, there is a nearly 30-point partisan spread, but it's nearly all Republicans, but it's still 2/3 of Democrats. Mm-hmm. And there's just wide agreement on those things.
You know, a big surprise for me was the drop in the number of respondents who see ours as a divinely ordained nation. Where do you think that change comes from?
Yeah, you know, we're going to still do some digging in on that question. But the question was whether people agree or disagree that God has granted America a special role in human history. So we've been asking this question for almost a decade. We first asked it in 2013. And if you kind of look, you know, overall, it's pretty remarkable that, you know, all Americans have gone from nearly 2/3 down to 44% agreeing with that statement. And it's dropped kind of across the board. So it's not just, you know, one segment of the country that believe that. Republicans still, you know, largely believe it. But I think we've seen the shift in particularly among Democrats and independents. I think it's linked to a couple of things. First of all, it's linked to the rise of religiously unaffiliated Americans in the country today. You know, so we've seen a rise in that group. They now represent about a quarter of the country. They were certainly under 20% a decade ago.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's part of it. And then I think there is this kind of growing divide, this kind of partisan divide, where I think Democrats are increasingly less likely, and particularly white college educated Democrats, increasingly less likely to tie American identity to a kind of Christian nationalism motif. Whereas Republicans, they dropped two, but less than other, the country as a whole dropped about 20 points, and Republicans have dropped nine over this time. So the decline is half as steep among Republicans. So I think it reflects this real shift in kind of view of a theocracy or a Christian nation or Christian nationalism. And I think as it's taken on more partisan and a tenor during the Trump administration, that's also, I think, what we're seeing here as well.
You know, I remember the first times that we started chasing the numbers of nuns. And it, I think it was slow at first, and now just what you just said tells us how we have changed in that way, in a remarkable way.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's right. I mean, not until the 2000s that you really start seeing, you know, so it's really a 20-year trend that's pretty remarkable. In the 1990s, for example, it was single digits. It was like, you know, 5-6%. Of Americans who claim no religious affiliation. And now, you know, our latest numbers have it at 23.
When we got to nine, people were really scared about that. But we've just kept going.
Yeah, now it's basically a quarter.
Yeah,
about a quarter of Americans.
Yeah.
And also just worth noting here, it's a quarter of Americans, but it is driven by young people. It's nearly 4 in 10 Americans under the age of 30 who claim no religious affiliation.
The fact that a growing number of us think life was better in the 1950s is discouraging, to say the least. I was there. What should we be thinking here?
Yeah, you know, this question we started asking actually, you know, prior to Trump even entering the political scene. But it turned out in 2016 this was one of the more predictive questions of support for Trump, is whether you thought American culture and way of life had changed for the better or changed for the worse since the 1950s. There's been some interesting movement where Republicans during the Trump years, for the first time, began to think things had changed for the better. But when we first started asking this question, you know, Democrats were twice as likely as Republicans to say things had changed for the better. Only about 3 in 10 Republicans said things have changed for the better since the 1950s. That number reached almost half during the last years of the Trump presidency. But I think it's notable that with Trump's loss and Biden in the White House, those numbers have dropped right back down. It's now, again, 3 in 10 Republicans. Now, obviously, that's a broad question. People could be loading a lot into it. But when we look at other attitudes, you know, what we see is it really is about a kind of vision of the middle of the 20th century post-war. Churches were full, and there was this sense of kind of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant juggernaut that was kind of in charge of everything. And I think it's that vision of, you know, a kind of white Christian America that is part of this nostalgic or kind of wistful look back by all white Christian groups are majority saying things have changed for the worst, actually, since the 1950s. White evangelicals are way up there, about, you know, more than 2/3. And again, Republicans are 2-1, say things have changed for the worse as well.
I was encouraged by what you found around national unity, despite the level of divisiveness that seems to be all around us. It looks like there is a lot more sharing each other's thoughts and what they think about our nation. And I don't see that in what we're seeing on television and hearing in the political parties.
Yeah, there are certainly some places. I mean, you know, the divides are still deep, but there are, you know, some places that we see it. We've already named one. What does it mean to be truly American? Mm-hmm. There are a set of traits there that people still largely agree across partisan and religious lines. You know, the other place where we found, you know, some agreement. Again, there's some partisan differences here, but on what kind of a country people want to live in, you know, we find more Americans than not saying they want to live in a country that's made up of people from all over the world, rather than being a nation that's primarily made up of people of Western European heritage. In fact, it's about half of Americans who kind of agree with that first statement, only less than one in 10 who say they agree with that second statement, and a swath in the middle, but more than not that are kind of leaning into the U.S. as being a kind of ethnically, racially diverse place.
What were the biggest surprises for you in the results of the survey this year?
That last one that we named, I think, is one of them. I mean, anytime you have 80% of Republicans and 90% of Democrats agreeing on anything, it's a big deal. And especially on something as divisive or potentially divisive and historically as divisive as what we should teach our kids about American history. I think that one to be important. The other thing is something economic here is that, you know, the country is experiencing, Americans overall are experiencing a fair amount of stress economically. And most of the country does not see this as just purely pandemic related. You know, the majority of the country say these are much longer term problems that we haven't really solved. We have, you know, big swaths of the country saying that the kind of everyday prices and inflation are rising faster than their wages are. And when we asked about even like basic goods, we had 4 in 10 Americans saying that they are somewhat very concerned about just paying for groceries every month, and a third saying they're concerned about being able to pay their rent and their mortgage. And those stresses are disproportionately falling on Americans of color, African Americans and Hispanic Americans in particular. That challenge, I think, is something that has been ticking up during the pandemic. And certainly we're talking about the relationship of, you know, these kind of cultural anxieties and this sense of it's a zero sum game. And if somebody else gets something, I'm going to lose. Mm-hmm. These economic pressures don't help us, I think, in kind of bridging the cultural divides. Mm-hmm.
What would you point to as the most noteworthy findings that we haven't touched on yet?
You know, this week I've made two appearances on CNN, and the one that has really grabbed the headlines this week, is one that's probably deeply troubling. I mean, you and I, you know, grew up in the South, and so I grew up where there was a lot of tornadoes, you know, in the South. And so you would get kind of two levels of warning. You would get a tornado watch, right, when the meteorologists sensed that there were certain kinds of clouds, the conditions were right for a possible tornado. But then you'd hear that siren rev up, you know, when an actual funnel cloud had been spotted.
Right.
And I think about at least one of the findings that we have in this survey as clearly moving us from that first level of watch to a warning. And I think we should be hearing the siren revving up. And that is that we found that 30% of Republicans today say that things have gotten so far off track that violence might be justified. They may have to resort to violence in order to save the country. And given the events of January 6th and the insurrection and the former president promoting the lie that the election was stolen and even kind of encouraging those violent actions, this is something that, you know, we can't just kind of ignore as just something fringe, but it's 3 in 10. And I think, you know, we talk on the religious landscape. What's also alarming is white evangelicals are the only group among whom a majority believe the election was stolen. 60% of them believe the election was stolen. And among that group that believes the election was stolen, 4 in 10 white evangelicals say they may have to resort to violence in order to save the country. So these are truly alarming stats. And I think something, you know, we really have to take seriously, particularly as we're heading toward big national midterm elections, you know, next year.
You know, I remember, Robbie, some years when we're going through this, we've always said, oh, my, the Republicans they're glad to be hearing this, or the Democrats, they're glad to be hearing this. I'm not hearing that this year.
Well, yeah, I think you're probably right. If I'm following you here, I think that this sense, I mean, the other thing about the partisan, two things here. I mean, that a majority of the country, slim majority, 51%, now believes the Republican Party has been taken over by racists. Mm-hmm. 44% of the country believes the Democratic Party has been taken over by socialists.
Yeah.
But if you ask partisans about each other, it's like 85% of Democrats who believe the Republicans have been taken over by racists. It's like 85% of Republicans believe the Democrats have been taken over by socialists. But it's not exactly even in the public. And, you know, when we ended at the end of Trump's presidency, we also found that nearly 6 in 10, 57% of the country believed that the sitting president of the United States was encouraging white supremacist groups. Yeah. 57%. Now, that's a question I really never thought I'd actually write as a social scientist about to test whether a sitting president was encouraging white supremacist groups. But I certainly didn't think, if I could imagine writing that question, that we'd be sitting at a time where nearly 6 in 10 of the country said they agreed with that statement.
Is it possible to characterize what we are talking about today as encouraging or discouraging for the future of our fractured nation and society?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm in the middle. I mean, I really do think we're at a fulcrum point here. I can't say that I'm optimistic. There's some places I can find some hope. There's some places where that deeply discourage me. But I think we're at a place for action, really. And that, that we really, if we want to save the democracy, if we, and frankly, if we want to save our religions, I think we're going to have to act, because I think we are at this kind of line in the sand. And if we don't do something, you know, I think very, very soon we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. Dr. Robert P. Jones is founding CEO at the Public Religion Research Institute, which has just released the 2021 American Values Survey. He's also the author of two powerful books, The End of White Christian America and White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. Robbie, it is always good to talk with you. Thank you for always being on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. I'm always glad to be here. It's always a pleasure and an in-depth conversation, so thank you.
The last time Randall Balmer was on our show, he had just published the influential tome, Thy Kingdom Come, How the Religious Right Distorts the Faith and Threatens America, an Evangelical's Lament. I think it's fair to say a lot that's happened during the intervening years was foretold in that book. And now Dr. Balmer is back with his latest, Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right. The author, a religion historian, is well equipped to examine this issue from both outside and inside the modern American evangelical movement. And I am grateful this book brings him back to State of Belief Radio. Randall, thanks for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure, Welton. Thank you so much. Good to see you again.
Most people think they already know the foundational story of modern American evangelicalism. Critically, you challenge that narrative. So let's start right there.
Sure. Well, if we go way back to the 19th century, I think one of the things that I'm trying to point out is that evangelicals in the 19th century were very much on the side of those who were marginalized in the larger society. They were concerned with those Jesus called the least of these. And they did so in certain particular ways. The issue of prison reform, for example, support for public education, because they saw that as a way for those on the lower rungs of society to advance themselves. Very much in favor of women's equality, including voting rights in the 19th century, and of course the issue of slavery. Now, I want to be clear, there were some many Southern apologists for slavery. I don't want to sugarcoat that or whitewash that, if I can use that term.
Yes.
But in the North in particular, evangelicals were very much concerned about issues of race and sought to end the scourge of slavery. And so you could juxtapose that with the contemporary political expressions of evangelicalism, and I think you find a rather stark contrast.
Why do you suppose this origin is not more widely recognized?
Well, I think the religious right is a very powerful media engine. And I think one of the reasons that people talk about the evangelical left or the religious left, and there certainly is such a thing, and I think you and I are both a part of that, yeah, in one way or another, but we don't have media empires behind us. And so for decades now, the leaders of the religious right have been insisting that their movement started in opposition to the Roe v. Wade decision of January 22nd, 1973, to be particular about it. Yeah. And more comprehensively, they've been arguing that this is a movement that is concerned about the so-called reconstruction of American society or defense of so-called traditional values or family values or something like that, when in fact the origins of this movement have less noble origins, let's put it that way.
I understand. I'm glad you mentioned the slavery thing. The church that I was in, the evangelical church that I was in, unfortunately never mentioned slavery and certainly never mentioned the way in which black people were being treated. But there were others who did fight the slavery thing. How did we get from there to here?
It's a fairly sad story, I think. And I think as I look back as a historian, the crucial decade was the 1970s. And a lot of things happened in the 1970s, as I'm sure you probably remember yourself, as I do. One of them, in terms of evangelical political activism, was a rather remarkable document that was drafted by 55 evangelical leaders in November of 1973, meeting at the Chicago YMCA on Wabash Street. And they crafted this document called the Chicago Declaration of Evangelical Social Concern. And I invite your listeners to look at it for themselves. It's on the web. Make sure you look for the 1973 version of that document. But for me, it was a remarkable restatement and reaffirmation of the principles that had guided 19th century evangelicals and their social concern. That is to say, it decried the persistence of racism in American society. It talked about the growing gap between the most affluent and those who were on the lower rungs of society. It decried the persistence of militarism in American society. And it reaffirmed evangelicals' historic concern for women's equality. It was a remarkable document. Mm-hmm. So you have that in 1973. Then, of course, you have Jimmy Carter's rise to the presidency out of nowhere, really. A one-term governor of Georgia who unexpectedly kind of ascends to the Democratic nomination and then election of the presidency in 1976. And Carter, of course, was and is an avowed born-again Christian, a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher who promised voters that he would never knowingly lie to the American people. And at that time, given Richard Nixon's proclivities in that direction, it was a radical idea that we would have a president who didn't lie to us. Yeah. And then, of course, we come to the issue that I think historical moment, which I think you're pointing to in your question. And that is the emergence of the religious right in opposition to Jimmy Carter, a born-again Christian, by the time of the 1980 presidential election. So I think the 1970s is a crucial moment for understanding contemporary evangelicalism and certainly the origins of the religious right.
You highlight the shift in evangelical support to the GOP during the Carter era, and in fact, you're the author of a book-length profile of that evangelical president. I'd like for you to say another word or two about how all of this pivotal moment came about related to him.
Yeah, the turn against Jimmy Carter is something that I remember at the time finding it just kind of incomprehensible. Why would evangelicals turn against one of their own in a period of 4 years from 1976 to 1980? And I think there are a lot of reasons for it. Certainly, Carter was not by many accounts, a successful president, although I would contest that, or at least much of that, because I think he was more, he deserves more credit than he has received. And historians, by the way, are finally coming around to understand that Carter was fairly effective in many ways. That said, it was a difficult time to be president, with inflation going through the roof because of the Arab oil embargo, the taking of the hostages in Iran and so forth. So all of that figured into it. But at the same time, certain evangelical leaders, including, and I'm reluctant to say this because I admire him a great deal, Billy Graham. Billy Graham was working behind the scenes to undermine Jimmy Carter going into the 1980 presidential election. And to make a longer story a little bit shorter, what happened is that these evangelical leaders, people like James Robeson and Robert Billings and Jerry Falwell, coalesced against Jimmy Carter in the course of his presidency, not, and I want to underscore this, not because of Carter's position on abortion, because Jimmy Carter had a much longer and more consistent record opposing the incidence of abortion than did Ronald Reagan, who, as governor of California in 1967, signed into law the most liberal abortion bill in the country. It had nothing to do with abortion. What it had to do was the perception, and this was a flawed perception, but it was a perception nevertheless, that Jimmy Carter and the Internal Revenue Service were ganging up against these evangelical schools, such as Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, because of their racial policies. And that is really what lies behind the turning against Jimmy Carter by the 1980 presidential election.
Well, today's political religious right coalesces around abortion and usually LGBT issues. Where does race play into their current agenda?
Well, I have to say that, Welton, that the 2016 election was a wake-up call for me when 81% of white evangelicals, and the modifier white is important here, decided to cast their political fortunes with Donald Trump, who, you know, I'm sorry, you can't make the case that he's an avatar for family values. You just can't make that argument. And I, you know, I, like most of Americans, I think we're stunned by this. And what I determined, I think, in the course of writing the book, Bad Faith, is that the 2016 election allowed the religious right finally to circle back to the charter issue behind the formation of this movement. And because we haven't been explicit about it yet in this conversation, I want to make clear that the religious right did not coalesce as a political movement in response to the Roe v. Wade decision of January 1973. This is what I call the abortion myth. We got the religious right going, and I have, you know, the book, as you know, contains multitudes of corroborating evidence for this, and extensive footnotes, everything anybody would want to know if you really want to go back and retrace my steps here. The religious right began as a political movement to defend, and there's no pretty way to say this, to defend the racial policies, racial segregation, at places like Bob Jones University and at so-called segregation academies, that is to say whites-only church-sponsored schools that had been formed to evade racial desegregation in public schools. That was the catalyst for the religious right. It had nothing whatsoever to do with abortion. Evangelicals considered abortion a Catholic issue throughout the 1970s. So come back to your question. The embrace of Donald Trump in 2016, I think, and I want to be careful here, but it has at the very least overtones of racism. And again, we can revisit Donald Trump's rhetoric to talk about whether or not he's racist. And no one knows the inside of an individual, so I'm always reluctant to identify someone as racist. But at the very least, he invoked racist rhetoric in his campaign for the presidency in 2016, throughout his tenure in office, and again, of course, in the 2020 presidential election. Mm-hmm. And there was something in that rhetoric that appealed to evangelicals. And I also want to make clear that I've spent much of my life defending evangelicals against the charge of racism. After the 2016 election, I'm not sure I can do that any longer, at least not as vigorously as I once did.
Today's Evangelical Catholic Coalition is a conservative force to be reckoned with. Is the role of reproductive rights exaggerated by analysts of this development as well, do you think?
Yeah, I wonder if it is. I mean, I don't really know. It's hard to kind of enter into the thoughts and the motivations of people who are involved in this sort of thing. But at the very least, Wilton, I would say that it has distorted things. I mean, you look at the Catholic bishops, and I've written about this in various times. The bishops now, of course, want to try to deny communion to Joseph Biden, who is a lifelong devout Catholic. And, I have to ask, in what moral universe do the bishops condemn Joe Biden and then at the same time fall all over themselves supporting Donald Trump? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So at the very least, I think the issue of abortion, or as you say, reproductive rights, has distorted political categories and political alliances in our current political scene. And to anoint Donald Trump as a pro-life champion, again, given his history and given his personal circumstances, it defies understanding.
Well, just this week, we saw political candidates, notably in the Virginia governor's race, leverage the relentless outrage of the political religious right about critical race theory in the classroom. That certainly fits into the ongoing problems that you describe in your book, doesn't it?
I think it does. I think it does. And again, one of the going back historically to the origins of this movement in the 1970s, Paul Weyrich, who's really the conservative activist who was the architect of the religious right. Yeah. I mean, what he did in the course of the 1970s was brilliant. I would say devilishly so, but he was a brilliant tactician, yes, because he was able to shift the rhetoric away from a defense of racial segregation to a defense of so-called religious freedom, right? It's the Internal Revenue Service is trying to come in and tell us how to run our affairs. This is the rhetoric that was used. And he thereby wrote one of the pages in the contemporary religious right playbook. Oh, the government is trying to tell us what to do. All the while conveniently neglecting the fact that tax exemption itself is a form of public subsidy. Now, anybody who thinks about that for more than 30 seconds recognizes the truth of that statement. Yeah. Right? Tax-exempt organizations, of course, don't pay taxes. That means the rest of the citizens, the public, has to come up with the additional funds. Now, I'm not saying that's wrong. I think it's certainly defensible. Yeah. The founders understood the value of voluntary associations, and so I'm not condemning that. But to say that trying to enforce racial integration in evangelical schools is somehow a stepping on religious freedom, just as in the Hobby Lobby case or the Colorado cake maker case, it's indefensible, I think. Yeah. And frankly, for the Supreme Court to go along with that such crazy reasoning, I think, is a real travesty.
So, Randall, where does this leave us? are there places that you see where healing is happening? Are bridges being built in spite of the political expediency of ongoing racial manipulation? Or is it too late to stop the exodus from organized religion that politicizing it like this has triggered?
Well, I think your question is hitting on a very important point, and you know as well as I that there has been an exodus from religion, at least religious institutions. You have, of course, the flowering of this spiritual but not religious stuff that is all part of the rhetoric. I think if there is any hope, Welton, for me, it lies with the younger generation, and certainly within evangelicalism. The younger generation is saying, wait a minute, you know, we have to examine our priorities here. We have to understand what's happening here. And by the way, I think the real wedge issue for the younger generation is the whole issue of climate change. Mm-hmm. And they understand the consequences of this because, of course, they have to live with it much longer than you and I do. And so they have a vested interest in it. But that I think, has been a kind of wedge issue. Mm-hmm. And I think once they begin questioning their elders, you know, our generation, then they begin questioning other things, particularly in the case of the religious right, the fixation on sexual identity, which really doesn't register with the younger generation. They just don't understand why this should be an issue, most of them, I think. Yeah. Or abortion, as we've been talking about. They're beginning to say, wait a minute, we need to look at this in a broader context and understand that there is a whole spectrum of issues that we might might consider moral issues, including issues of poverty, the environment, as I said, equality, and so forth. You know, look at our immigration policies, particularly under the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. How do you square that with the New Testament? How do you square that with the Hebrew Bible? Mm-hmm. And the idea of welcoming the stranger, treating the foreigner as one of your own. Yeah. Now, those issues are complicated because you have to deal with issues of national sovereignty and so forth. I understand that. But just deliver these sort of blanket condemnations of anyone who doesn't look like we are, I think a younger generation recognizes that as being inconsistent with the teachings of Jesus. Yeah. So that's where my hope is.
Dr. Randall Balmer is a religion historian, college professor, prolific author, and ordained pastor. His powerful new book is titled Bad Faith, Race, and the Rise of the Religious Right. Randall, it's been great to have you back. Thanks for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure, Welton. God bless.
That's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.